Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, good morning. Welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. Well, I want to say thank you to all the listeners, almost close to 800,000 downloads of the podcast. Wow, I'm just amazed and blessed and just wanted to say thank you, thank you, and thank you. I hope you have enjoyed the shows and learned from them, shared them with friends and family. I've had so many wonderful guests on, singers, actors, scientists, environmental people like the guy today, and just wonderful conversations, and I've just learned so much along the way. So I wanted to say thank you to that. I also really want to encourage you to follow me because I'll be giving away some copies of the book today by author Bill Powers, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Myth, the Natural Gas Supply Myth. And so you really want to read about this because there's so many different stories out there in the news from the government, from environmental groups, from neighborhood community organizations. You know, which one do you believe? Which one is true? Which one is not? I think you got to read a couple different things to get to the root of it. But there is a problem, and there is a lot of lying. I'll just say they're lying. People are lying to you about what's going on with the natural gas industry. So today I'm talking with Bill Powers. I believe this is him on the line. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. This is Bill.
Hi, this is Joy Keys.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
Thank you so much for agreeing to call in. I'm excited about today's conversation. We really could talk for 2 hours about this subject, but we only have about 20, 25 minutes, so we're going to be moving at a fast pace. But you did a lot of work. I mean, you have, I don't know, what is it, 100 pages of almost just notes and sightings and things in the back of the book, which I really appreciate because I said, well, who is this guy writing this book? How does he know there's not 100-year supply, and who has he been talking to, and where is he getting his information? So it's nice to see the documentation, the research behind your writing. I appreciate that.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, and the book took almost 4 years to write. There's almost 600 footnotes in the book. You know, and this is not opinion. This is not, you know, this is not made-up puffery. This is basically production history, factual production history, and these are, you know, estimates based off of production history, not theories or not, you know, someone's, you know, dream of energy independence.
Well, let's start at the beginning because some people are not familiar with natural gas, shale gas, fracking. They might have heard about it in the news just barely, but maybe they don't live anywhere where environmentally it's being affecting them. So let's start at the beginning. Natural gas, what is natural gas? Where does it come from?
Basically, natural gas is a hydrocarbon that comes from rocks that are, you know, or shale gas in particular, that comes from the breakdown of organic material. In the case of shale gas, that is stored in shale formations. And then in the case of shale gas drilling, the modern shale gas industry involves the drilling of horizontal wells and then hydraulically fracturing those wells and producing the gas out from there. So that's basically what shale gas is.
Let's explain that natural gas was discovered from my reading, not just from your book, but almost 1600s. The discovery of natural gas around Lake Erie. So natural gas has been with us or been being used for quite some time. Your book is saying that we don't have 100 years. Now, you mentioned a couple things in your description. You talked about horizontal drilling, hydraulic fracturing. From 1600s to now, the ability to extract this gas has changed. Talk about that, the ability to get to it.
Correct. The first shale gas boom in this country got started in 1821 after in Fredonia, New York. That was the first well that was drilled into the very, very shallow Devonian shale.
It was 27 miles.
It was about 25 feet deep. And
25 feet, I'm sorry. This set off a
boom for factories as well as homes that in western New York along Lake Erie that really tapped into the shale through very rudimentary, basically water wells where pipes were into the ground. And a lot of these wells produced for decades, and some of these wells still produce today that were drilled, in the 1900s. However,
one of the things, Bill, let me just say something real quick. One of the unique things about that particular play, as they call it, I guess, is that it had some natural occurring, like it naturally emitted the gases, whereas you didn't have to dig and do all this specialized techniques that we have now, correct?
Correct. You basically were able to put in a pipe into the ground into a very shallow shale formation that the gas mm-hmm. would just produce without any fracturing or any advanced completion techniques. This is the very early stages of the oil and gas industry in the United States. And if just to make a kind of a point of reference, this was before oil was discovered in Pennsylvania. This is very early on. So, but today, if we fast forward almost 200 years, today's shale gas, the modern shale gas industry, which is a term I use in the book often to make a distinction between the early 1800s and today, we drill into very deep shale formations where there are mm-hmm. no naturally occurring fractures. So the well has to be hydraulically fracture stimulated, which is a very energy-intensive process. It's quite costly, and there can be environmental impacts depending on whether there's human error involved or not.
So now you're saying that we don't have 100 years, and I'm going to go back to that again.
Mm-hmm.
How is it measured? How do we measure how much shale we have in these plays? They call them plays. Some of the biggest yep. ones you mentioned are Barnett and Marcellus shale in the United States, but also you mentioned there are shales outside globally. Qatar, you mentioned, was a very large shale. How do they measure how much is there and how much we'll have in the future? You mentioned in your book about different types of measuring, exponential curve, hyperbolic
yep.
decline. But
yeah.
try to break it down simple for the people.
Okay, no, that's no problem. I mean, we'll start with the U.S. When people say we have a 100-year supply, what they're referring to is resources. And resources are, technically recoverable, which doesn't mean much of anything. It just means that there may be shale that someday may be produced. However, that's a very meaningless term. What I try to focus on in the book are reserves, which are reserves as well as production history, because the biggest indicator of how a field or a play will perform in the future is how it's performed in its life up to that
right.
point.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
so what I look at is where do we go from here? And right now we have five shale plays that have been in production for a number of years that are now into decline: the Antrim Shale of Michigan, the Barnett, the Haynesville, the Woodford, and the Fayetteville. All of those plays are into decline. We do have some younger plays, such as the Marcellus and the in Pennsylvania and the Eagle Ford in Texas, that are still growing, however, at a much slower rate. And what I really
Bill, let me just interrupt you for a second. You said the plays are in decline. Explain that to the audience. What do you mean decline?
Okay,
they're not producing as much. Do you think they could potentially find more?
Their peak deliverability has already been reached, and the plays are now producing less gas than they had at some point in the past. And this is what is not widely recognized, is that, you know, there are only two plays left in the United States in the shale industry that are still growing, the Marcellus and the Eagle Ford. And a lot of that growth is being offset by older shale plays that are already into decline. But really, what I try to get to in the book is a matter of perspective, is that, you know, when people say, well, there's going to be, you know, the Marcellus may recover, you know, 400 trillion cubic feet, and these are ridiculous numbers, and I try to make it very clear in the book, because the biggest field in the Western Hemisphere, not just the United States, but the Western Hemisphere, is the Hugoton Field of Kansas, and it has produced 35 trillion cubic feet over 70 years. So in my book, I go out and say, well, even if we are, you know, I'm optimistic on the Marcellus, and I think it's a big mm-hmm. field, and it may produce 50 trillion cubic feet, which would make it the biggest field in the Western Hemisphere by, you know, 50%. And still, you can only get to a six-year supply of shale gas in the United States. And so,
well, one of the things you mentioned, let me just mention that in
sure.
your book you talk about there's homogeneous and heterogeneous, and what the predictions from the government, T. Boone Pickens, different people, Exxon, even on the government's website, talking about there's homogeneous and heterogeneous. So they buy these large pieces of, you know, large acreage of land, potential, thinking that there are lots of hot spots, so to speak, when in actuality, 100 acres may only have, 20 acres of hot spots. And so the predictions are skewed. Is that correct?
Correct. What has happened is that there have been some very successful wells that have been drilled in all of the shale plays. However, all of the commercial wells in all of the shale plays come from a very small portion of the acreage that people may view as productive. And so, really, you know, the Marcellus doesn't stretch over, you know, 13 million square miles. It may go only over, you know, 2 million square miles. We don't know how big that will be because we don't have enough history. But in the older plays, such as in Michigan and in Texas with the Barnett, we know exactly how big the field is, how the aerial extent of the field, and that way we can make extrapolations. And one of the things that is very important is that in shale, in the shale industry, and for the most part, and much of oil and gas, is that you can drill wells that are fantastic next to a dry hole. And in shale, it was widely believed early on that these fields, you would get similar results across a wide area. And that has not turned out to be true. And that has led to mass overestimation of the future recoveries of shale gas.
In the New York Times, they were leaking that in some emails from 2011 from the United States Energy Information Administration. They were expressing concerns about the economic realities of shale gas production. One of the things that you talk about is deliverability, and you mentioned several incidences across the country that have happened where the natural gas industry could not deliver because they didn't have it, and they actually had to cut off, I guess, supplies to the industrial customers in order to give to, say, the local, you know, like a person or individuals. Talk about that a little bit, the issue of deliverability.
Sure. The book starts off with a quote from Mark Twain: "History does not repeat, but it sure does rhyme." And the book ends with that same sentence. And what I try to make an analogy is between the gas crisis of the 1970s and what we're heading towards. In between World War II and 1970, we had about a 400% increase in both gas production and demand. This was the booming era of U.S. manufacturing. And by early 1970, we started to see industrial users start to get cut off because demand was outstripping supply. And this got progressively worse through the 70s and up until 1978, when President Carter outlawed natural gas use in industrial boilers and other things to really cut demand, we saw gas prices go up 12-fold in the 1970s. This led to many industrial users getting cut off, schools getting closed, people losing their jobs. rising heating costs, rising electricity prices, and unbeknownst to most people is that we did not drill our way out of the 1970s gas crisis. What happened was we built hundreds of coal-fired coal-fired power plants.
Yeah, coal. We talk about coal. Mm-hmm.
And we put on several dozen nuclear power plants in the 1970s. Nuclear power went up almost 1,200% in between the early 70s and the early 80s. And so we had a decline in production, even though prices went way up. And that's what I think we are heading towards, because we are getting towards the peak productivity of shale gas. But that's only part of the story, in the sense that we have declining conventional production, declining offshore production, declining imports from Canada. So the U.S. is going to be faced with a very difficult situation as demand starts to outstrip supply and prices go up.
Let's talk now. We only have a few minutes left. We need to switch over to this environmental and health concerns, and also solutions. You talk about some solutions. But let's first start off. And recently in the news, they brought out a story that some children were given a lifetime gag order because Pennsylvania. What do you think about that? They cannot, these non-disclosure things, but this is on children because they cannot discuss things that were happening, like the water blowing up, people getting headaches, people getting nerve damage, people, the water being brown coming out. What are your thoughts about these non-disclosures and given to people once their land is bought? And now on children, this is ridiculous.
I'm certainly not a fan of that. I don't know how that is possible legally. I'm not a lawyer. However, what I do want to make very clear is that there has been a lot of environmental damage done in states like Pennsylvania, simply due to human error. There were not sufficient deterrence to not using best practices. And so we had a lot of wells that were completed with very poor cement done. Cementing is, if you go back to, that is the number one cause of environmental damage. And this is a very avoidable problem. And if mm-hmm. the fines were not heavy enough, the punishments were not severe enough to deter users from producers from cutting corners, and so I do think that there are ways to extract gas safely. However, there needs to be a lot of safeguards in place to ensure that damage is not done to the nearby environment.
Well, according to the White House, President Obama did start an interagency working group to support safe and responsible development of unconventional domestic natural gas resources. But many things that I've been reading, the oversight is just not there. As you mentioned, the safety is not there. And also, some things can't be contained. For example, they were using evaporation sprays, I think, to get rid of the wastewater. But then those evaporation sprays are going into the air. So natural gas is supposed to be better for the environment and help with these emissions, but then it's creating more. Are you familiar with these evaporation sprays that are being used?
I mean, I am aware of that, that process had been done in Wyoming during the development of coal bed methane in the Powder River Basin. However, as far as elsewhere in the development of shale plays, I'm not aware of instances where you've seen that type of waste disposal. One of the things that is important is the proper disposal of frack water, and because what goes into the ground is not necessarily what comes back up, and what comes back up may be even more toxic than what goes in. So this is something that I think that really the state levels, and people should be aware of what's going on in their state, because unfortunately in Pennsylvania, we had what I refer to as regulatory capture, in the sense that a lot of the politicians, a lot of the regulators were essentially in the pockets of industry, which allowed them to, which allowed industry to kind of make up its own rules. And fortunately, we're seeing some of this being reversed. But, you know, this is something that, you know, people, you know, should continue to be vigilant towards, you know, making sure the rules are enforced and that, you know, the fines are severe for people who cannot follow the rules.
Let's talk about some solutions. We got solar. You're talking about that in the book. You talk about nuclear, geothermal. Talk to us about, okay, we don't have 100 years of natural gas, so what are we going to do? How are we going to power ourselves and not be cold, hungry, and in the dark?
Yes. This goes back to, you know, individuals, what can they do? What can each individual do to reduce their gas consumption? And one of the things that I think is the most important thing is finding ways to electrify and heat your home with limited gas usage. And the best way to do that is residential photovoltaic solar panels. These have come down in price tremendously. They've increased efficiency enormously. And now in places such as California, they are at grid parity with grid power. So we are seeing, I think, the beginnings of a distributed power revolution that I talk about in the book, where people, you know, decide, do I, you know, and, you know, if they heat their home with fuel oil, instead of changing to natural gas, maybe putting in a geothermal HVAC system makes more sense. Putting solar panels on their roofs is going to make a big difference. Having hot water heating via solar is used throughout the world, but very little in the United States. That's going to make a comeback. Also, putting on
solar. Is that because of pricing? I mean, you're talking about a lot of solar issues. I mean, a middle-class person, can they afford to put solar panels on the top of their house?
Well,
terms of apartment buildings in urban areas, how can they, you know, how can that be used?
That's a good question. As far as for homes go, one of the things, if you don't want to go out and buy solar panels, there's now over a dozen companies in the United States that will rent solar panels, and they will collect the tax breaks, and you will sell them back the power that is generated from those solar panels. And the rental agreement with these companies is usually 20 to 30% less than your utility bill every month. So even though you don't own the solar panels, you can get, you can benefit from this. As far as people who live in apartment buildings, and, you know, that is a different story, because obviously there's only so much you can do to, if you're not able to make adjustments to the outside of the structure.
Outside, yeah.
But one of the things that I also think is important, and I'm a big believer in, and I talk about natural gas vehicles in the book, I, you know, sincerely believe that those are a very poor idea. And one of the things that I do believe...
Yeah, you have a whole chapter on that. That was incentivizing them to go... That was one of the things that the industry pushed the government, say, hey, you know, natural gas, and they got a lot of tax incentives and breaks. So that they were saying, well, we need to get this natural gas, and we can make these vehicles and so on and so forth. So it was like this chain reaction.
Correct. And we saw the big champion of that was Boone Pickens, who has made some outrageous comments about the amount of gas that is in the United States. And I think that natural gas vehicles are a terrible idea, given how costly the refueling stations are and how costly the infrastructure would be, as well as to buy the vehicles. And a far better solution is electric vehicles. And, you know, people can now there are solar carports available. You can put solar panels on your roof. There's over 5,000 publicly available refueling or charging stations out there, and there's going to be
electric cars.
Thousands more. It's far, far less expensive to install a EV refueling station than it is a natural gas refueling station by a huge margin. It's only at the at the $5,000 or $6,000 for most EVs, whereas it's over $250,000 to $300,000 to put in a publicly available NGV refueling station.
So there are a lot of things that we need to talk about in this country to get people more aware of what's going on with the natural gas situation. I would encourage everybody to check out Bill Power's book, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark. I'm going to be giving away some copies, so follow me at Joy Keeve and become a fan on Facebook. Also follow Bill Powers. He's on Twitter, Bill Powers 1970s. And also you can check out his website, PowersEnergyInvestor.com. Again, PowersEnergyInvestor.com. Bill, thank you so much for coming on today. We have run out of time, but a wonderful book. I really appreciate, again, all the research that you had in the back so that it wasn't just fluff and, just stuff off the top of your head. So thank you for that. And I wish you much success with this book.
Thank you so much, Joy. It was great being here.
Okay, you have a wonderful Saturday.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with author Bill Powers, Cold, Hungry, and in the Dark, Exploding the Natural Gas Supply Myth. Wonderful book. Check it out. I'll be giving away some copies. Again, follow me at Joy Keyes. Become a fan on Facebook. You can win a copy of the book. Coming up in a couple minutes, understanding drug addiction. You know, what is it? Who's susceptible? How it affects families and communities. Is it recoverable? It's a disease, but you can get help for it. So tune in a couple minutes, learning about drug addiction, substance abuse. You guys have a wonderful Saturday.
I'm Ellie the Mammoth, and my friend Sid the Sloth knows what being a great parent is all about.
I love kids.
It starts with believing you can do it.
I'm responsible, loving, nurturing.
You've got to set a good example.
Hey, no biting. Uh-uh.
And give a whole lot of love.
I love you so much.
And you'll get a whole lot back, too. The rest? Well, that's up to you. Remember, you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Visit AdoptUsKids.org for more information. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.